Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. An investigation into the man Scotland Yard thought, but couldn't prove, was Jack the Ripper. Dozens of theories have attempted to resolve the mystery of the identity of Jack the Ripper, the world's most famous serial killer. Ripperologist Robert House contends that we may have known the answer all along. The head of Scotland Yard's criminal investigation department at the time of the murders thought Aaron Kosminski was guilty, but he lacked the legal proof to convict him. By exploring Kosminski's life, House builds a strong circumstantial case against him, showing not only that he had means, motive, and opportunity, but also that he fit the general profile of a serial killer as defined by the FBI today. The first book to explore the life of Aaron Kosminski, one of Scotland Yard's top suspects in the quest to identify Jack the Ripper, combines historical research and contemporary criminal profiling techniques to solve one of the most vexing criminal mysteries of all time. The book draws on a decade of research by the author, including trips to Poland and England to uncover Kosminski's past and details of the case. It includes a foreword by Roy Hazelwood, a former FBI profiler and a pioneer of profiling sexual predators. Features dozens of photographs and illustrations, building a thorough and convincing case that completes the work begun by Scotland Yard more than a century ago. This book is essential reading for anyone who wants to know who really committed Jack the Ripper's heinous and unforgettable crimes. The book that we're featuring this evening is Jack the Ripper and the Case for Scotland Yard's Prime Suspect, with my special guest, ripperologist, journalist, and author, Robert House. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Robert House.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me on the show. I've been a fan for a while, so happy to be on.
Thank you very much. Great book. This did not come out this year, so maybe you can tell us what year that came out, but let's talk about how you came to this story. Your background, I mentioned you're a ripperologist, so tell us the amount of time that you dedicated to this, studying this case, and before we talk about what you did in the pursuit of the main suspect and how you came to find that out, that information, and make that determination. So to give us a little bit of background on yourself and as a ripperologist, and tell us then about how you came to endeavor to write this incredible book and do the research necessary to do this.
Sure. So I'm a... You know, I'm a graphic designer by trade, so everything I've done in the area of researching Jack the Ripper has been done in my spare time, you know, kind of as a hobby. I initially got interested in it around the year 2000, and, you know, at the time I was honestly just reading a bunch of history books, not specifically true crime, you know, just history books in general, and I just, you know, somewhat randomly picked up a book on Jack the Ripper by Philip Sugden. And it's called The Complete History of Jack the Ripper, I believe, and it's, you know, it's a really great book. And, you know, I just got sucked into the mystery of the case like so many other ripperologists have done. But there was, you know, there was this one particular suspect that I became interested in. And this is Aaron Kosminski, who's the suspect I wrote my book about. You know, Sugden effectively dismissed him as a viable suspect in the Jack the Ripper case. And the more that I thought about this, the more problems I started to see in his argument, I guess I would say. you know, and the more I thought about Aaron Kosminski, he just seemed actually like he was a very good fit for Jack the Ripper. So I started doing, you know, just a little bit of research in my spare time, mostly pretty much all online. I started reading a lot of other books on serial killers. And, you know, the real break in my own research came when basically I discovered Aaron Kosminski's genealogical records in Poland. You know, Aaron Kosminski has been known as a suspect in the case since 1987 when he was discovered by Martin Fido, but very little was known about him. Very little is still known about him, in fact, but, you know, at the time it was known that he came from Poland, but, you know, almost nothing was really known about his family or, you know, where he was from. So I did this search for his genealogical records in Poland, and it was, you know, I just submitted a search request. At that time, I did not travel to Poland, so I submitted a search request in the Polish archives. You know, and to do so, I had to have a pretty good idea of where in Poland he was from, because Poland is divided into gubernias, and the their archives are not centrally, you know, digitized or anything like that. So I had to, you know, submit this request, have it translated into Polish, and, you know, I found these records. And then from there, we got, you know, the names of all his siblings, the names of his parents, and that led to subsequent discoveries in England, because we were then able to search, you know, for records of his siblings, for example. And, you know, that led to a bunch of other things. And so, you know, I was doing this research in my spare time for, you know, 5 or 6 years, and I discovered a lot of information about Aaron Kosminski that had not been previously known, so I decided to write a book, and the book came out in 2011. That's basically it in a nutshell.
Now, I want to ask you, you mentioned Martin Fido, so let's talk about who he is, and again, we just glossed over what happened in 1987 that was a new development for Ripperologists. And tell us how Aaron Kosminski's name came up in 1987 as a result.
Yep. So I'm going to jump back a little bit to 1910. The main reason that Aaron Kosminski is such a prime suspect in the case is because in 1910, Robert Anderson, who was the head of the Criminal Investigation Department at Scotland Yard, wrote a autobiography in which he stated that, contrary to popular belief, the police actually knew the identity of Jack the Ripper. But in the book, he did not name the suspect. He said, out of you know, concerns for being sued for libel, and, you know, really because he said the reputation of his department would suffer because the police don't tell tales out of school. There are various other reasons why he, you know, wouldn't name a suspect in a case like this. But he never named the suspect. And in the 80s, the grandson of the person who was actually the head of the Jack the Ripper investigation at Scotland Yard, who worked under Anderson, was a man named Donald Swanson. And his grandson discovered that Swanson had owned a copy of this book. And in the book, where Anderson declined to name the suspect, Swanson actually wrote the suspect's name in the margin in pencil. And he wrote Kosminski, but he only gave the last name. So Martin Fido in 1987... you know, Martin Fido is a well-known Ripperologist, and he decided to try to discover a person named Kosminski in the asylum records, because Anderson stated that Kosminski, you know, was insane and ended up in an insane asylum. So Martin Fido did a search through the asylum records, and he only discovered one Kosminski, and that was Aaron Kosminski. You know, ironically, FIDO dismissed Aaron Kosminski as a viable suspect almost immediately, which I've always found to be, you know, incredibly odd, because you would think that the person who discovered him would want to, you know, sort of take the credit for solving the case once and for all. But that wasn't
right.
That wasn't what happened. And Martin FIDO came up with a sort of an alternate theory. I won't go into the details, but that's how Aaron Kosminski's name came to be known. So his name's really been known since the 80s.
What was the reasoning for FIDO dismissing Kosminski after he had discovered Kosminski? What was his rationale?
So his rationale, and most people's, you know, the common reason that Aaron Kosminski is dismissed is because people say, A, he was an imbecile. He's commonly described as being an imbecile because, well, it's really because he was initially entered into Colney Hatch County Asylum, and then he was transferred to a place called Leavesden Asylum for imbeciles. That was reason one. Reason two is that there's a document written by a police surgeon who certified Aaron Kosminski as insane. I'm sorry. No, his admission record to Colney Hatch states that he's not violent. Because there was an entry on the form that said, you know, is this person violent? And he wrote no. So those are the two main reasons really why he's dismissed and why FIDO dismissed him. But there are other aspects of his asylum records that also led them to dismiss him as well. For example, the person who certified him as insane wrote down among the reasons that he goes about in the gutter and eats food out of the gutter. You know, things like that. He was also, his asylum record also states that he was a compulsive masturbator. That was given as the reason for insanity, in fact. So, you know, all of these things added up to, you know, sort of paint a picture that was very different from the way most people picture Jack the Ripper when they think of him. You know, he's thought of as being this cunning, sort of supervillain. And here you have Aaron Kosminski, who's a, you know, Jack the Ripper is also commonly thought of as being, you know, sort of an upper class person. At least that's how he's portrayed in films. Like the Johnny Depp film, you know, he's portrayed as an aristocrat or sometimes as a doctor. You know, so here you have Aaron Kosminski, who was unemployed, lower-class immigrant, who was insane, you know, going about in the streets, picking up food out of the gutter, and said to be both an imbecile and not dangerous. So, you know, the more I actually looked into some of these things, I realized that, you know, a lot of these arguments are actually quite weak. Because, for one thing, he was not an imbecile. The term was actually, you know, a strictly defined legal and medical term in the 19th century, which meant the equivalent of what we would now call, you know, a mentally retarded person.
Right.
But the fact is that the imbecile asylums took in both people who were legally defined as imbeciles and also people who were legally defined as lunatics.
Right.
The main reason, you know, a person would end up in a so-called imbecile asylum was if he was deemed to be untreatable. So, you know, Aaron Kosminski almost certainly had schizophrenia. You know, so the doctors at the time would have determined that he was untreatable, and hence he was transferred to Leavesden. You know, the part about not being violent is also somewhat contradicted by his asylum records, in which it states that he was at times violent. He actually threatened to attack one of the asylum attendants at one point. And it's also documented in his record that he attacked his own, or he threatened to attack his own sister with a knife.
Right.
But, you know, when he... You know, when these forms are being filled out, you know, they're asking probably his brother, who was the person who brought him to the workhouse to be seen by a doctor. you know, they would have asked his brother, you know, is he violent? And the brother said no, and he simply filled that in the form, you know, which is a perfectly normal response. And, you know, you can picture the same thing could have been said of Ted Bundy or Gary Ridgway if they were, you know, being entered into, you know, entered into some form. You know, somebody who knew Bundy would have said he's not violent. So, you know, these objections to Aaron Kosminski start to sort of fall apart. And the more you look at him, he actually fits the, you know, what you would think Jack the Ripper was actually like. And once those objections are gone, then you see that the case against him is actually quite strong. Although very little is still known about him as a person, to be honest.
You did extensive research, like no one else has, as you mentioned, about Aaron Kosminski himself and his family background as much as you could find. And so there's some extrapolation or inferences, but basically incredible mm-hmm. amount of information. But before we get to that, what I found was interesting is you really do a great job of vividly describing Poland and Europe before we get to Britain and then describing Britain. But I'd never heard, you know, this other background for Kosminski. But what's interesting before we get to that is to explain how important they thought masturbation was to insanity at that time, just to sort of give the listener some idea of the mindset at that time.
You know, to really understand what was going on, you have to understand that insanity was very poorly understood. You know, it was starting to be understood a little bit better towards the end of the 19th century, which is the period we're talking about. But, you know, there was very little treatment for it. There was very little understanding of schizophrenia, which, you know, at the time was referred to as, you know, something else. Could have been referred to as dementia praecox or, you know, mania, something like that. But, you know, so, you know, in the Victorian era, you know, masturbation was commonly thought to cause not just insanity, but, you know, all sorts of physical ailments, which now we look upon as, you know, being rather silly. But, you know, that is entered in his record as being the cause of insanity. You know, one thing I pointed out in my book is that, you know, the FBI's behavioral studies unit, this group of kind of serial killer experts that includes John Douglas, Roy Hazelwood, you know, they conducted extensive interviews with serial killers in, right. I believe, the 1980s to, you know, sort of start to have some kind of, you know, data-based understanding of serial killers. So they could look at them, you know, kind of in a statistical manner. And, you know, so they're looking at common traits of serial killers. And I believe they interviewed 37 known serial killers. And one of the, you know, one of the most common traits, I think it was, you know, 80% or something, was compulsive masturbation. You know, so although people kind of joke about this, you know, when they're, you know, sort of making fun of Aaron Kosminski as a suspect, you know, it's actually it's a very common trait among serial killers.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, and also what I want to mention too, that you found as well to disprove the imbecile argument or dismiss this imbecile argument, because for all official records, he was considered not an imbecile, but an actual lunatic, and you found that information,
mm-hmm.
which is a big distinction. So,
you want me to go into that a little bit more?
Well,
I mean,
if you like, sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I really read quite a bit about the history of, you know, both insanity and lunatic asylums in England specifically. You know, and like I said, there was really very little treatment for people who were insane in the 19th century. And, you know, for the most part, people who ended up in insane asylums were mostly managed, really. You know, there was not much of a sense of treating them because they didn't have any sense of what they could do. So, you know, it was a lot of sort of restraint. Towards the end of the 19th century, they started using chemical restraint. But the, you know, the sort of taxonomy for how insane people were categorized was quite primitive. And, you know, there was, you know, like I said, legally speaking, three broad categories for insanity. One was lunatic, another one was imbecile, and the third one was person of unsound mind, which it's actually quite unclear what that really meant. I looked into it, and I read one person who did a pretty extensive study of asylum records, and he couldn't really tell that there was any, you know, determining factor between lunatic and person of unsound mind. But you know, it shows. You know, to an extent, the brutality with which these people were treated, that, you know, people who were, you know, mentally retarded effectively were just lumped together with insane people. They were all, you know, kind of put in these places and, you know, treated really quite badly. So for me to understand what an imbecile asylum was, you know, required me looking quite a bit into the history of asylums in England. You know, the fact was that the asylums were overcrowded, and, you know, the doctors, towards the end of the 19th century, they did start to think more about ways of treating people who were insane. But for the cases that they determined to be untreatable, they would just sort of shuffle the person off to a, you know, what in my book I call sort of an overflow container. You know, just get them out of here and send them off to that other place where they're just going to be basically managed. And so the imbecile asylums really were, you know, they housed both imbeciles and lunatics. And, you know, they were kind of designed to have only people who were nonviolent as well, people who were considered harmless. But then, you know, that distinction also fell away, and they just started taking anybody, really. There was massive overcrowding in these places. So
you do an incredible job of talking about the atmosphere and the environment at the time in Poland that likely shaped or did shape Aaron Kosminski's future mindset. And so what you have is Poland in the late 18th century, and you talk about how weakened Poland had been because of Russia and Prussia and Austria. And so tell us about, as you do start in 1772, and talk about the atmosphere and the environment and the sentiment. So tell us about that.
You know, I won't go too much into the history of it. You know, to be honest, I'm not, I wouldn't consider myself to be an expert in, you know, the history of Poland in the 18th century. But, you know, it was a very weak country at the time. And the, you know, these three bordering countries, Russia, Prussia, and Austria, you know, effectively had a treaty that was designed to, you know, weaken Poland. And, you know, ultimately the country was basically liquidated and, you know, broken up and divided between those three countries. So, you know, in doing so, Russia took over what had been, you know, a large part of eastern Poland. And, you know, at the same time, they, you know, that meant that a lot of Jewish people in Poland were sort of absorbed into the Russian Empire. And, you know, throughout the 19th century, you know, at that time, Russia was a very toxic and anti-Semitic atmosphere for Jews, who were really treated as, you know, second-class citizens with limited rights. You know, they were sort of confined to a geographic area called the Pale of Settlement. And within that, you know, they were restricted to only work in certain trades. Travel was restricted. And you know, there were all sorts of sort of legal means of, I guess, you know, keeping them an oppressed sort of underclass in the country. You know, and at the same time, there was, you know, anti-Semitism that extended, you know, right from the top, you know, the Tsar and people like that, down to, you know, the peasants. So, you know, it was a horrible atmosphere for the Jews. And, you know, as I write about in my book, in the, you know, middle and late 19th century, there were, you know, periodic outbreaks of pogroms in Western Russia against the Jews. The particular one that led to the emigration of the Kosminski family was after the assassination of the Tsar in 1881. You know, he was assassinated by a group of, I don't know if I want to call them anarchists. They were actually people who were trying to establish a sort of a democratic republic in Russia by overthrowing the Tsar. Well, he was assassinated anyway in the street by assassins who came out and threw bombs at him. And, you know, the Jews were scapegoated by several newspapers, although they had nothing to do with it, really. And this led to the outbreak of, you know, massive riots across, you know, a large area of Western Russia against the Jews. And they were, you know, extremely violent. It's hard to really imagine the scenario, but, you know, the depictions that I've read in newspapers are, you know, really horrific. People being killed, you know, tossed into, you know, houses being burned down and bodies being tossed into the burning flames and babies being thrown out of windows and, you know, I mean, just horrific descriptions. And so this led to, you know, a massive wave of Jewish refugees fleeing Russia and going west. A lot of them ended up going to America, and a lot of them ended up going to London, you know, where this is where the Kosminskis went. So, you know, Aaron Kosminski went, emigrated to London with his brother and sister. His older brother had already gone there about 10 years earlier. And, you know, also, as I read about in the book, the sentiment towards Jews in the East End got quite anti-Semitic and violent as well, because they were, you know, kind of resented as, you know, immigrants competing for jobs. There was high unemployment in London at the time. So, you know, throughout the decade, the Kosminskis arrived in about 1881. The Jack the Ripper murders were in 1888. And, you know, between those two periods, the anti-Semitism really was on the rise. And it was really at a breaking point just at the time the Ripper murders began. So, you know, like I said, very little is known about Aaron Kosminski, you know, about the quality of his family life and, you know, things like that. But, you know, this is the general environment that he experienced, you know, so you have to consider when the family emigrated to London, he would have been 16 years old. And, you know, just experiencing that level of anti-Semitism and hatred and being surrounded by violence, you know, I sort of speculate in the book is the type of environment that can, you know, lead a person to develop the level of hatred that, you know, serial killers do.
With that, you talk about what Aaron Kosminski could have witnessed, in that you said it was there were frequent rapes from the Russians against the Jews. So he had sisters that were in their 20s and a mother. So he could have, you said, could have experienced that kind of violence, even rapes of his own sisters or mother, or at least known of rapes or witnessed other violence sexual assaults, and all kinds of other violence before he left. And then, like you say, then he gets back to London, and it's the same kind of anti-Semitic, again, hatred and violence. Again, you talk about the profiling, and you get in this book, and you talk about the geographical profiling as well. So talk a little bit more about the profiling and what you learned from the profile in terms of comparing it to the information that you did have about Kaminsky's, at least, environment and the extrapolation of likely how he did grow up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, so some of this comes from the study that the FBI did that I referred to earlier, where they sort of list common characteristics of serial killers, and those include things like unemployment. You know, Aaron Kosminski was unemployed. It includes instability of residence, which means, you know, a lot of moving, and, you know, the speculated that you know, keeps a person from developing attachments to people. You know, and Kosminski obviously, you know, emigrated. He was a refugee coming to a strange place where he didn't speak the language, you know. Lack of a father figure is often cited. Aaron Kosminski's father died when he was 9 years old. It's unknown how. You know, but he was really raised in a family that would have been, you know, as I say in the book, dominated by females, his older sisters and his mother. The only other male in the house was his brother, who was a few years older, but his older brother had left, you know, in the 1870s. Then there's, as I said before, compulsive masturbation, you know, so things like that. Kosminski, you know, matches all of these characteristics. There's also, you know, just as I said before, you know, this sort of toxic and hateful atmosphere generally that he, you know, was raised in. You know, something that I researched more after the book was published actually was specifically about the type of serial killer that Jack the Ripper was. You know, the FBI refers to this type of killer as a post-mortem mutilator because his primary interest really was in mutilating bodies after death. So, you know, unlike Ted Bundy, you know, Bundy would be considered a sadistic serial killer because he derived pleasure from sort of torturing his victims. Or, you know, Jack the Ripper was not this type of killer. You know, he actually killed his victims quite quickly. But then, you know, performed extensive mutilations, probably cannibalism. And, you know, this type of killer is often, you know, insane, by which I mean schizophrenic. Not always, but if you look at schizophrenic serial killers, and they're quite rare, they often commit crimes that were quite similar to Jack the Ripper. You know, I say they're quite rare because some of the people who are considered generally to be schizophrenic serial killers may well have been faking it. I'm thinking of Berkowitz, possibly Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. But if you look at people who are, you know, clearly schizophrenic serial killers, people like Richard Chase, Herbert Mullen, you know, their crimes were quite disorganized and, you know, often involved mutilation of the bodies after death, cannibalism, things like that. So, you know, just in, you know, kind of across the board, Aaron Kosminski fits with, I think, the type of killer you would be looking for generally.
How did Sir Robert Anderson and Donald Swanson come to their conclusions with with Aaron Kosminski?
Yeah, so the police would have known quite a bit more about Aaron Kosminski than we know today, because they almost certainly interviewed him, questioned him, probably they must have interviewed his family members, and there would have been some kind of suspect file on him that's now been lost. So what has survived is just these little snippets of, you know, documents that mention him. You know, the short answer to your question is it's not really known why Anderson came to the conclusion that Aaron Kosminski was Jack the Ripper. But he seemed quite definite about it. The way he puts it in several different interviews is he said it was a moral certainty, which is actually a legal term that kind of means, in a nutshell, it means we couldn't prove it legally, but he was convinced anyway that Aaron Kosminski was Jack the Ripper. You know, that said, the surviving documentation on him comes from, you know, Anderson's book, the Swanson's writings in the margin of the book, which is referred to as the Swanson marginalia, you know, fills in some of the gaps. And then there's a document called the McNaughton Memorandum, which was written by another detective at Scotland Yard, sort of summarizing some of the top suspects in the case. In that, he says that Kosminski had a great hatred of women, especially prostitutes, and you know, he had homicidal tendencies. But probably the most important thing that's known anyway is that Aaron Kosminski was actually identified by a witness. Anderson writes about this, but very little is known about it. You know, it's not really known who the witness was, although most people think it's a person named Joseph Lowand or Lavender. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce the name. He was a Jewish person, and he declined to testify in court as to the identification. You know, Anderson writes that he refused to testify against a fellow Jew. Swanson wrote that. But you know, I mean, to be honest, it's not really known why he refused to testify, although I've always imagined that it could just be that he was not really 100% sure about the person he saw. But, you know, Anderson does say that he was positively identified and that Kosminski himself sort of knew that he had been identified. In other words, he somehow reacted at the time to indicate perhaps, you know, guilt, something like that. But so it's not known exactly what happened, but for some reason Anderson became convinced that that this was the person. You know, I often think of as a comparison what happened with Gary Ridgway when the head of the Green River Task Force was, you know, absolutely convinced that Gary Ridgway was the Green River Killer, but they couldn't prove that either, despite the fact that there was, you know, really a mountain of circumstantial evidence that linked Ridgway to the Green River crimes, but they just did not have the evidence that would have been required to convict him until they got the DNA evidence. And I suspect that something similar may have happened in this case, where they had a lot of circumstantial evidence, but Anderson was a lawyer, so he knew that probably whatever they had was not going to be sufficient to convict.
Now, you do extensive research. What I found, one of the most profound parts of the book is that you look into this insanity claim that Kosminski was insane, and then find out when, officially, it looks like he was institutionalized and the conditions therein on which he was institutionalized with family members. So tell us what you did uncover in that area.
You mean as far as how he ended up in the institution?
Yes.
You know, so like I said, he was schizophrenic, almost certainly. If you read the descriptions, you know, he's described as having auditory hallucinations. He heard the voice, which he describes as an instinct that informed him of the movements of all mankind. He claimed, you know, sort of that he claimed that this voice told him not to drink water out of the tap, and not to eat food that was given to him. And this explains why he was, you know, looking for food in the gutter. You know, schizophrenia is a degenerative disease, and you know, nowadays it's treatable with drugs, but at the time it was completely untreatable. You know, Aaron Kosminski's insanity would have, you know, come on kind of slowly, I guess. And by the time he's been in the asylum for, you know, 20 years, he really had degenerated to the point where he's, you know, mumbling and incoherent and things like that. But, you know, it was said that that the first signs of insanity started in 1886, which was, you know, 2 years prior to the murders. Right. He was basically brought to a place called Mile End Old Town Workhouse by his brother, you know, to determine whether he was insane, basically. You know, so it's important to note that his family had him committed, basically. He was brought to the workhouse. It's almost 2 years after the last Ripper murder. So there is a gap there where there are no murders, and people have asked why there are no murders, you know, during this time when he was out on the streets. But he was brought to the workhouse, and then he was released from the workhouse, and then he was brought back 6 months later, and at that time he was looked at by a police surgeon who determined that he was insane, and at that point he was committed to Colney Hatch. Colney Hatch Lunatic Asylum. And then he stayed there for 3 years, and then he was transferred to Leavesden, and he stayed there for the rest of his life, and he lived to the age of 54 and died in 1919. You know, Swanson writes, for example, that he was brought to the workhouse with his hands tied behind his back, so he was clearly brought there against his will.
Right.
And it's been speculated whether the police were sort of involved in having him committed. You know, I don't want to go off too much into the realm of speculation here, but you have to wonder if you're in this situation where you believed you know who Jack the Ripper was, but you couldn't really do anything legally. You know, is it possible that the police sort of facilitated a situation where he could be admitted to an asylum that he would never be released from, to sort of, you know, as a sort of a solution to the problem, that they would handle, you know, quite discreetly, as a matter of fact. So there are, in my opinion, several indications that whatever happened with Aaron Kosminski was kept pretty quiet in the police department, you know, which makes sense, at least in my mind, given, you know, the level of anti-Semitism that there was in London. You know, there was almost an outbreak of riots at the time of the murders because the Jews were again blamed. You know, the police, in fact, destroyed one of the key pieces of evidence, which was the Goulston Street graffito, because they were worried that that was going to lead to anti-Jewish riots.
Right.
So, you know, it's entirely possible if you're looking at a situation where you have a Jewish suspect, that the police would not want that to get out in any way. So, you know, I personally believe that they covered up what happened with Aaron Kosminski. you know, even if they couldn't prove that he was the killer, I think that they didn't want any kind of word to get out about him as a suspect. And, you know, there are little snippets of things here and there that I believe support that theory.
In keeping with that thought, though, I thought that when in the book, when you talked about the Jewish witness, didn't the Jewish witness to Kosminski at least say that it was a possibility that they were interested in not having that kind of riot ensue? If this witness that was Jew, regardless of him coming forward, the perpetrator was Jewish, and with the Jewish anti-Semitism already, is that not valid, or at least possibly valid, that that witness, even though he ID'd Kosminski, didn't, in afterthought, thought maybe not a great idea?
It's entirely possible, I suppose. You know, there are actually even some Jewish sources who argue the same point, effectively. You know, I personally believe that it may have been sort of a combination of that combined with really, you know, I mean, witness, this type of witness identification is notoriously difficult, you know, notoriously mm-hmm. faulty. I mean, false identifications are, you know, known to be extremely common. You know, Joseph Lowand, who was probably the witness, said at the time that he would not be able to recognize the person again. It was dark. You know, they were quite a ways away. He only caught a glimpse of the guy. You know, and is he going to be able to identify him a year later? You know, it's highly unlikely, but it was really the best that they could do. So maybe they, you know, showed him Aaron Kosminski and said, is this the person? And he might have said, it looks like him, I think. You know, but if you all of a sudden realize that you are the sort of linchpin of the whole case, that the whole case rests on you, you may really give a second thought to whether you want to testify, especially given the, you know, the situation with anti-Semitism in the East End. That's more the way that I think about it. You know, one of the things that is written about this identification is that he did not want the person to be hanged, you know, based on his evidence and to have that on his conscience.
Sure.
You know, so there's a lot of pressure there, I think, and, you know, I really doubt that he could have been 100% in his identification anyway. You know,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, that said, you know, there was a positive identification. I mean,
right.
There's no, yeah.
Part of your investigation included the geographical profiling, which is a little bit more recent, or more recent type of profiling. But it's important as well because it can answer some questions and support your theory. Your idea mm-hmm. that Kosminski is the man. So tell us about what you did in terms of that investigation into the geographical profiling of
mm-hmm.
Kosminski.
Yeah, so geographical profiling, there's many different types of it. You know, it uses sort of mathematical modeling of the crime scenes and other geographic factors of, you know, the particular area where murders are, you know, taking place. You know, the Jack the Ripper murders all took place within walking distance of each other. You know, unlike, you know, some modern-day crimes like the Yorkshire Ripper, where he was driving around in a car, the East End of London was, you know, Jack the Ripper was walking around the area, basically looking for victims. You know, one of the most basic types of geographic profiling involves what's called circle theory, where you just simply draw a circle, the smallest circle possible that contains all the crime scenes, and then, you know, use that as a sort of predictor of where the killer lived. Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a very crude sort of method, but even doing that, you know, Kosminski lived within half a mile of you know, the center of a circle that would contain all the crime scenes. I have walked around the area myself. I sort of understand the layout. I understand where the scene was. Where Aaron Kosminski lived was comparatively, you know, kind of a residential, quiet area. The part where all the sort of prostitution and the bars and all the action was happening was a little bit north of there. So he may have walked up to that area and then just sort of wandered around looking for, you know, victims, and then walked back home. If you look at some of the, there are some indications of, the route that Jack the Ripper took after the murders. The best one really is the Goulston Street graffito, which I referred to. And basically in that case, the killer cut off a piece of Catherine Eddowes' apron. Catherine Eddowes was the victim in Mitre Square, the fourth victim of Jack the Ripper.
Right.
And the killer cut off a piece of her apron either to wipe his hands of blood or to possibly carry away one of the organs. In that case, he took away two organs from the body. And then that rag covered with blood was discovered, you know, several hundred yards to the east of where the crime scene was. And it was left next to this piece of graffiti that, you know, like I said, became a clue. It said the Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing, which is very cryptic and difficult to understand. But, you know, it gives you a clear sense of the direction that the killer walked after committing the murder, which is east. And, as I, map this out and, knowing the area, it's exactly the direction that Aaron Kosminski would have walked to basically go home because, in my mind, he would have avoided the main thoroughfare, which is Whitechapel High Street, and he would have gone on the slightly more back street, which ran parallel to it, to the north, which was Wentworth Street, and that's, gone down that street, crossed over Whitechapel High Street, and gone to his house, which was, less than a mile away. But that direction that the killer walked would have been exactly the direction that Aaron Kosminski would have walked to go home. Same could be said for what's often speculated was the so-called getaway route for the killer after committing the Nichols murder. It was speculated that the killer went through sort of an alley that led to, again, Whitechapel High Street and sort of over near the London Hospital. Again, this is the exact route that Aaron Kosminski would have gone to walk home. Another example is the murder of Elizabeth Stride. She was the third or fourth victim, depending on, who you count as victims of Jack the Ripper. And the crime scene there was, within probably less than a 1 minute walking distance of where Aaron Kosminski was probably living at the time. That murder in particular, there was a witness who saw a man actually attacking a woman right at the location where the body was found, 10, 15 minutes later. There's a lot of debate among Ripperologists about whether this person was Jack the Ripper. I personally believe that he probably was. And what this witness saw, the witness name was Israel Schwartz, was, a murder in progress, effectively. That Schwartz testimony said that he was walking down the street called Burner Street, and ahead of him he saw a man walking the same direction but kind of stumbling as if drunk. And when the person came up to this woman who was standing in the entrance of a courtyard, he basically attacked her. And, again, walking down, south down Burner Street, this is exactly the direction that Aaron Kosminski would have gone to get to his house, which was on Providence Street, probably, which was Providence Street, was one block south of Berner Street. You know, so John Douglas, for example, theorized that Jack the Ripper probably went out, frequently at night hunting for victims. And he also speculated that he would drink, you know, get drunk in the bars. So if Aaron Kosminski went up to, Commercial Street or Brick Lane, the places where all the pubs were, and got drunk and wandered around for a while and then was walking back home and he's drunk, you know, this is exactly the direction he would have walked to get home, is down Berner Street. And this is exactly what Schwartz saw, was a man walking down Berner Street, you know, in that direction, who then attacked a woman who was probably Elizabeth Stride. So, you know, you start to add up all these little pieces, and it just, like, everything just kind of fits perfectly, given the theory that Aaron Kosminski was Jack the Ripper. And there are so many little pieces like that. If you look at any suspect in the case, the more you learn, often, the more you start to see that it just doesn't really quite fit. There's something that doesn't quite, fit with this person. He was either, not there. You know, Walter Sickert, for example, who Patricia Cornwell wrote about, was almost certainly in France at the time of the murders. So the more you dig into these suspects, you'll find something that kind of disqualifies them. You know, with Aaron Kosminski, it's been the exact opposite. The more that I research and the more that I find out, you know, he fits exactly with every aspect of what is known about Jack the Ripper. You know, one example I was going to give one example, which is something that I found in my book. There's a sort of a famous suspect in the case referred to as the Batty Street Lodger. I don't know if you've ever heard of this person before. Yeah. But it was a story that was reported in the newspaper where a lodger in a house dropped off some laundry to his landlady, and the landlady discovered blood on it. And then the police, started conducting surveillance and, it turns out that the story was actually misreported, but the newspaper, and this is discussed in a lot of books on Jack the Ripper, but they don't really discuss the fact that the newspapers in the following days updated the story with probably more accurate information. The fact is that there was never a lodger at all, but there was a person apparently who dropped off some laundry to a laundress who worked on Batty Street, which is just one street to the east of Berner Street and one street north of Providence Street where Aaron Kosminski lived. And, there was a shirt that had blood on it, and she alerted the police to this, and the police arrested the person eventually and interviewed this person and released him. And, the newspaper reports described this person as being a ladies' tailor who lived a few hundred yards from the crime scene, who worked for a West End house, and this fits perfectly with Aaron Kosminski's brother, who was a ladies' tailor who lived, a few hundred yards to the north of the crime scene. And this had never been noted before, to my knowledge, in any Ripper book. But then it had never been known that his brothers were ladies' tailors, really. There's also the fact that Aaron Kosminski's brother removed his daughter from school, and she was going to school at a place called the Berner Street School, which was directly opposite from the crime scene. And he took her out of school exactly, I think, one day after the Batty Street Lodger story first appeared in the newspapers. You know, so these things start to kind of add up where you, mm-hmm. You can imagine, I suspect that the family suspected Aaron was the killer and didn't know what to do about it, but we're probably talking about it in the home, kind of in hushed tones. And, it's the type of thing that you don't want a 10-year-old girl to overhear and start talking about in school. So they removed her from the school. This is all speculation, but, if you look at the dates, it matches perfectly. is a coincidence that she was removed from the school one day after, you know, this newspaper report about the Batty Street Lodger. So, you know, I try to avoid speculating, but, you know, it goes to show you how little is actually known. But, you know, like I said, these things, they all sort of fit together. You know, I've described it like being a jigsaw puzzle where you have very few of the pieces, but, you know, there's a lot of pieces missing, but you start to see the picture and everything, you know, is fitting together.
Yes, it's you've done a masterful job putting that puzzle together. Before I let you go, I want to ask about the origin of some of the photos, the incredible photos that you have in your book. So tell us a little bit about all these incredible photos that are included in your book, and maybe tell us a couple of the interesting sources where you got some of these from.
A lot of the photos in the book are ones that have been, you know, known in Ripper, you know, Jack the Ripper books for a long time. You know, the photos of the victims. I also have photos of Kładowa, Poland, which is where Aaron Kosminski was from, and I traveled there myself in 2008 and took some pictures. There are photos of the modern day locations of the streets where his siblings lived in the East End of London, which, you know, they look quite different now than they did then because, you know, all these old row houses were demolished. But there's a very nice photo in the book of the street where Aaron Kosminski's brothers lived, which is called Greenfield Street. There's a great photo of Donald Swanson in the book that has never been published before, and I got that from his great-grandson. You know, it's interesting because I also briefly had in my possession Donald Swanson's pistol because his great-grandson bought it from a, you know, kind of an antique gun dealer here in the U.S., and, you know, I kind of conducted the transaction myself, and I had this gun at my house, and it's an old you know, it's a Tranter pistol from the 1880s. It's inscribed with a little, you know, escutcheon on it to Donald Swanson. It's a very small gun actually, but it was really interesting to have that, you know, in my possession for 6 months or something like that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really good photos in the book of the, you know, the crime scenes. There's a photo of Aaron Kosminski's grave that I visited, which is in the East End of London. And, you know, it's the inscription on the grave is just literally deteriorating, you know, it's dissolving, which, you know, as I say, is kind of fitting, really, for him as a person because, you know, he's just so little is known about him. It's almost like, you know, it's fitting that the inscription is disappearing almost the same way that he sort of appeared and then disappeared in history, really. And there's other good pictures in the book. There's nice maps that show the layout of all the crime scenes and where he lived.
Yeah, very, it's an incredible total package. This Jack the Ripper in the case for Scotland Yard's prime suspect. I want to applaud you for this. I want to ask you if there, for those that might be further interested in your work and this book and anything else that you are doing, do you have a website?
Mm-hmm.
You do Facebook. Tell us a little bit about how people might be able to contact you or get more information about you.
I do have a Facebook page for the book. You know, Jack the Ripper and the Case for Scotland Yard's Prime Suspect on Facebook. You know, the book's available on Amazon and other online stores. You know, if somebody has any questions or wants to send a message, they can send it through that Facebook page and I should get it. You know, my personal website is much more geared towards my work as a designer, so there's nothing really on there right now about the case. But yeah, I mean,
well,
I encourage people to buy the book.
Absolutely, it's great book. And for anybody that has read anything about Jack the Ripper, this is shocking that we really do get a pretty good idea of the best suspect, according to the police at the time. And thanks to Martin Fido, and then your follow-up and your incredible adventure to try to dismiss or have this person as the suspect. And you've done a great job in painting the likely Jack the Ripper. And it's a fascinating book. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Jack the Ripper and the case for Scotland Yard's prime suspect. Thank you very much, Robert House.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
You have a great night. Good night.
Okay. You too.
Bye-bye.